Please do.
Thank you, and if it pleases the court, my name is Jeff Meyer. I represent Dennis Teague, Linda Colvin, and Curtis Williams, and this appeal is about that sentence. My clients share names with other people. That's common. Shared names are commonplace. But we have figured out, practically and easily, how to identify the person despite the shared common names, except at the Department of Justice until yesterday, when they took that first step to try to do the thing that has been missing, which is undertake the responsibility to try to identify the person about whom a criminal background check has been requested. When they do that, when they finally accomplish the task of identifying the person, I suspect my clients will have no claim because the problem will have been solved. But until that happens, neither the UPIN that has been suggested nor the caveat that has been at least partially and I hope universally implemented, neither of those two changes change the underlying legal analysis or solve the problem. Now, before I turn to the legal argument, I want to have clear in our minds two facts. Fact number one, the match is remarkably unreliable. Mr. Lennington can, of course, explain it in more detail, but in essence, the department's position is that a rap sheet will be returned if there is any possibility of some similarity. The evidence of that is that Anthony Terrell Parker, the criminal whose record is associated with my client Dennis Teague, once used Dennis Teague's name, but never used Dennis Teague's date of birth. There is no match on these two personal identifiers that we use every time we go to the doctor's office. A name that has to match a date of birth, and there is no match.
So if I understand you correctly, you're saying this record is inaccurate under the statutes because the report is inaccurate.
Is that correct? That's the challenge statute argument.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
And it's inaccurate because the two don't have the same date of birth? It's inaccurate because the two, Mr. Teague and whoever it was, don't have the same date of birth?
Well, that's the most obvious inaccuracy.
Okay.
Under the language of the statute, it is inaccurate because the association of Parker's information about a real live individual in the database, is associated with Dennis Teague, my real live client. That association of the information is what's inaccurate.
Well, in the association that's inaccurate only occurs when a report is generated.
Correct.
Okay, so we need to focus on the report, not on the database, but really on the report that's generated. That's where your complaint lies.
Yes.
They maintain the database is pretty much up to them as long as the reports they generate don't turn out to be inaccurate.
As long as they don't associate the wrong person's information.
Well, I mean, you know, your complaint is that the statute says you challenge them because they're not accurate.
Yes.
So I guess I like to rely on statutes. To me, they're always easier than constitutional questions.
Yes.
So I have been focusing on 1970, and I understood very well, particularly your reply brief just hammered it home that we're not complaining about their database.
Correct.
We are complaining because the report is inaccurate.
Yes.
Correct?
Okay. But we can see that, I mean, clearly, positively, absolutely, where the dates of birth don't match at all.
Okay, but if they can fix it under the statute, then you don't worry about all the constitutional claims that you brought to us. You just want it fixed, right?
Yes, correct. Okay. That's absolutely correct.
Well, it's easy to say you want it fixed, but it appears to me that there's no, let me rephrase that. Do you know how it should be fixed, given the testimony of your experts at trial? Are you in a position here today, and reading your brief, it seems like at least in a couple of references, you are suggesting it be remanded to determine what process should be employed.
The fix, Your Honor, depends on the legal theory. There is a different remedy under the open records balancing, because under that statute, it is the global, the universal balancing that is inconsistent with this court's decisions that say, no, the balancing must be case by case, document by document. That's a different kind of relief than Justice Robinsack's observation that 19.70 gives us two statutory results, you know, concur and correct, or deny, notify, allow.
Let's go through very briefly, if you can, the remedy or relief that you're seeking. You have an amended complaint asking for declaratory judgment and prospective injunctive relief. You have two statutory claims, 19.356 and 19.70. I understand by your answer on 19.356, you're asking for, I think, a remand to do the balancing test on an individual basis. Is that correct?
That's correct.
With regard to your claim under 19.70, what relief are you requesting?
I think the remedy under 19.70 is really it's essentially an obey the law injunction. The statute tells us the two options that they have, right? Concur and correct. So the judicial relief is grant plaintiff's motion for summary judgment and direct the department to comply with 19.70. The exact specifics on how they comply, this record doesn't support. I have some ideas. I'm sure Mr. Lemington has some ideas. That strikes me as being appropriate to work out at the circuit court level.
That might be a little bit more than the judiciary generally gets involved with, directing Department of Justice on how to do things as long as they're in compliance with the statute. I can't remember us ever having quite that much management over DOJ.
Yes, and that's why I say that the relief appears to me to come from the judicial branch to say, well, follow the statute.
Right.
Don't do the thing that you are doing, which is either issue an innocence letter, or now they've decided we'll throw in a caveat. Neither of those are within the statutory language of 19.70.
What relief is allowed under the statute for your client? I'm a little concerned about judicial review and what we can and what we cannot do under the terms of the statute. Talk to me a little bit about that and your reliance on Wasnicki.
I'm interpreting the judicial review language of your question to refer to the 19.3651 issue, the statute? Okay. This litigation is not an action for judicial review. Right? We know, as lawyers, we know what a judicial review looks like. It is a specific determination about a specific, in this circumstance, a determination about a specific request. If a newspaper says, give me the criminal background check on Dennis Teague, I would say that is something that looks like judicial review. We've brought an action that says, your method, and I think we proved it, your method of conducting the Open Records Act analysis that you are supposed to be conducting is unlawful. And that action, that request to the judicial branch, is not an action for judicial review. It is a civil action for prospective runoff, and those are different animals. We have brought an action that is not an action for judicial review, although admittedly we are asking the third branch to weigh in here and declare that the department's practice that we proved is unlawful.
And it's the prospective relief part that I'm curious about. Where do you find that authority for the court?
Prospective relief in a civil action, the declaratory judgment section. I'm drawing a blank on its number. And the ability to issue an injunction. Both of those are statutory authorizations for this court to grant prospective relief that we've asked for.
Counsel, if you could help me out with section 19.356, that last clause, it prevents judicial review, quote, of the decision of an authority to provide a requester with access to a record, close quote. Do you acknowledge that the claim that you brought relates to the decision of an authority to provide a requester with access to a record?
Part of it does, yes. Part of it does not.
Okay, so to the extent that it does, then the preclusion of judicial review would apply. So is it your argument that judicial review is a limited term of art and it does not apply to a request for declaratory judgment?
It doesn't apply to a request for judicial relief that the method by which you, agency, are generally conducting the business is inconsistent with the statute, right? Judicial review, as the court said in, you know, the Shorewood case, I believe, maybe it was the Mortgage Associates case, but judicial review is reviewing a specific set of facts previously found by an agency. And our challenge here is to the refusal of the department to make the inquiry that they have to make under the, you know, Open Records Act, but also under the challenge statute. And that because that is not within the judicial review language, it's not within our understanding of what a judicial review is, any relief that the third branch is authorized to issue,
right,
is appropriate.
Okay. Let me just interrupt for just a moment. I'm not sure your characterization of judicial review necessarily matches the language of this statute. So you say it applies, judicial review is something that is done, that is a review of a set of facts already occurred. And that's not this case. And yet the language of the statute says the judicial review is of a decision, right? And you are challenging a decision.
No, we're challenging a decision that we reasonably believe is going to be made at some point in the future because we know that the department is using a improper legal analysis.
Yeah. And the decision that you're concerned about is the decision to provide a requester with access to a record.
No, it's also the decision not to release the information about successful challenges. It's both. Now, you know, maybe the department will say that they are now changing their practice and that they are now going to release the accurate information about the successful challenges, in which case your argument would be halfway home, I think, but it doesn't address, your observation would be halfway home.
I don't have an argument here.
Your observation would be halfway home if it were not for the other sections of the same statute, the sections that give employees a guaranteed right to privacy to their home address, their social security number, and their email, and that give public officials the right not to prevent disclosure, but to supplement the record that is going to be released. The same legislature that adopted that judicial review language conferred these two really specific provisions guaranteeing non-disclosure. The court has to ask itself, how do those people who clearly have a right enforce that right if the Court of Appeals decision is allowed to stand? And the short answer is, they can't. So, You come back to what's the meaning of judicial review in sub one, and we've given you, I think, a very logical reason, an analysis that says this is the review of a particular decision on a particular request, and that that is what we recognize as judicial review. It's not a bar to litigation by the public official to be allowed to supplement the record. It is not a bar to an employee who knows, who predicts reasonably that his government is going to release his Social Security number in violation of the law. That citizen has a right to sue. And they have a right to sue under our Constitution. And it's not within the meaning of subsection one.
Right. So it's an intriguing argument, and perhaps a case will come where that is called into play. But I'm a little concerned about that argument because there is a statutory right not to have that released, whereas I'm not sure there's a statutory right here for you to have an innocence letter included with the record request.
No, but the legal issue is what does subsection one mean? What does the language in subsection one mean? And it has, I think, a narrow meaning that I hope we all agree, cannot preclude the public official from suing to compel the prospective relief of being allowed to supplement the record that's going to be released, and it cannot be construed to prohibit the public employee from protecting their Social Security number and their private email and their private address.
But doesn't that make a substantial difference to your argument that in the case of the protection against having your personal identifying information released, that that's a statutory right not to have that happen, versus the position of your clients in this case, which is there is no statutory right to have the innocence letter incorporated.
Yes, but that's just one statutory right that happened to occur in exactly the same statute that adopted the judicial review language. I also have a separate statutory right for my tax returns not to be released, sold by the government because they think they're going to make a profit selling my tax returns. But that's a separate statute adopted before this preclusive language on judicial review. There are a number of different provisions that a citizen appropriately asks the judicial branch to enforce their rights on that have to do with suing the government. And some of them involve disclosure of information.
Counsel, your opposing counsel, I think based on the Moustakas case, perhaps, makes this comment on page 32 of its brief with regard to the issue of what does judicial review mean? And it is stated, and while the legislature chose to limit pre-release judicial review. So as I read that and looked at the record that we have, here, I mean, you had the report, I think, before you filed suit here. It's part of the record, it's part of the trial, it's on page 65 of your second appendix.
Yes.
So, when you take, it says this, and while the legislature chose to limit the pre-release judicial review in WSSTAT 356 sub 1, that chapter provides no limit on post-release lawsuits to recover damages or other remedies as provided by law. I took that. Your case isn't looking for damages. You're looking for a remedy as provided by law, and it is a post-release lawsuit. This interpretation of what judicial review, when I first read that, or when I read that statute in preparation for the case today, I said to myself, whoa, Nelly.
And your name isn't even Nelly.
No, I said, what's going on here? What are you guys, can you bring a lawsuit? And then I started reading the cases, and particularly the Moustakas case that went through what does this statute mean, and it's pre-release, they said, and it's analyzed in context of the overall change of the statutory scheme, revising Wasnicki, and it went into that. And so I'm not sure why you even need to make your argument that it is a judicial review isn't the same as declaratory relief. I mean, I understand that argument, but I don't even know why you have to make it, because that was dealing with pre-release judicial.
Yeah, the short answer to your question, Your Honor, is that pre-release, as used on page 32, is not a statutory term. It's a characterization that makes sense in the context of a request for a particular record in which the agency has made a decision, I am going to release this.
And well, let me stop you. I mean, you say pre-release on page 32. Quite frankly, I point to page 32 because that's what's said. But for me, with all due respect, I give more authority to our precedent and what we've said rather than what's on page 32. And our precedent clearly says this is pre-release judicial review.
For that request, right? It is the whole statute, 19.365, is geared around pre-release judicial review, because it triggers a pre-release duty to notify. And so in that context, it makes absolute sense to talk about pre-release judicial review, because we're talking about a very specific set of facts, right? One request, a decision by an agency, a statute that says, whoa, Nelly, hold up, don't release it, give notice, and allow the judicial branch to go through the process. That looks like a judicial review based on that specific request, based on the response of the government. But that's different from a lawsuit that says your entire process of thinking about how you keep your records violates the law. And that's
a request, a very specific request involving a very specific individual and access to that individual's personnel records versus a systematic automated distribution available to anyone.
Exactly.
In regard to anyone the government happens to keep records of.
That's exactly the distinction between why I think this case doesn't come within the language the legislature used for judicial review. The discussion has been about the statute, and I don't want to ignore the constitutional arguments, in particular the procedural due process argument.
That's the stigma plus. Give us
That's
your stigma,
stigma plus.
Plus
analysis, and the thing, the relief, as you asked earlier, on that claim is different from the other two, because the relief on that claim is find that there's a protected interest, reverse and remand for the Matthews versus Eldridge balancing test. That's where we determine what process is due in these circumstances. And the circuit court never got to that point, because the circuit court made the erroneous decision, one, the clearly erroneous finding of fact as to absence of stigma. And we've argued that now twice in two briefs. The department has not pointed to a shred of evidence that supports that finding. Absence of stigma. So there is a stigma. Plus comes from the fact that we have an information system here that's a million copies a year that the department is now producing. That's different from Paul V. Davis taking a flyer around to a store and saying this person is believed to be a shoplifter, or this person might pass bad checks. When the government chooses a business model to issue credentials a million times a year, they are creating a status conferring engine. They pass out good citizenship, good housekeeping seals of approval, of law-abidingness to innocent people, and we hope they pass out criminal record information about criminals. But they have created the system that confers this status, and it is a status that is at least as important as driver's licenses, and it's a status that the government has chosen to create, and that's what makes it a protected interest.
Thank you, Counsel.
I see my time is up.
You do, and you have 5 minutes on rebuttal, so if there's something else that you wanted to add, please do so at that time.
Good morning, Deputy Solicitor General Daniel Lennington for the respondents in this case. DOJ's record check system serves a very important public purpose. It provides quick, cheap, and easy access to over 1.4 million criminal records. The system is queried about a million times a year by nonprofit organizations, businesses, individuals, and government agencies. I'd like to make two chief points in response to the arguments by petitioners here today. First, the legislature has specifically barred Teague's public records claim under Section 19.356. And two, plaintiffs' other claims fail because the record check system returns accurate information that has never harmed any of the plaintiffs.
Counsel, as you started your comments, these requests, up to a million now a year apparently, come from nonprofits and individuals, other organizations. I assume, for instance, as it was in the record, and that it's correct, that there are certain entities that, not just for employment, but for volunteer purposes, have to do records checks. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm a Sunday school teacher at church, and they ran one on me.
That's exactly what I was thinking of. So let's say Teague, I mean, or one of my friends, or one of my relatives is unfortunate to be a victim of the crime of identity theft and wants to be a teacher at Sunday school or wants to volunteer at the Salvation Army in the food kitchen and has no idea that to volunteer they're going to do a records check on me. I mean, I'm volunteering. You know, it's not like I'm trying to get employment. And they're precluded not only from employment by your records check, but from volunteering and not even knowing some of these times that these records checks are going on. So you talk about no harm in your comment. And I, quite frankly, I think there is harm. And what concerns me is it's harm to victims of crime. And what concerns me is we have a constitutional amendment that starts that this state, as a matter of public policy, this state shall treat crime victims with fairness, dignity, and respect for their privacy. Here the claim is a violation of private reputational rights. What are you doing to these crime victims is my concern. I mean, I say that not with regard to the legal arguments presented, 19.356, 19.70, equal protection, due process, but with regard to Article 1, Section 9M and your responsibility to not throw crime victims under the bus.
Thank you. I think that's a critical question here.
Yeah, and it concerns me.
How I'd like to respond to that first is to describe what is the product that is being purchased, and then what does the response say? The product being purchased is a name-based search that DOJ says to the users, and the trial testimony is that the users of the system are very savvy, typically HR professionals, nonprofit presidents, people who want to make very conscientious and careful considerations, but we tell them, we say, you submit a name to us and a date of birth, we will search all the names in the criminal history database, but be careful, be forewarned, because we search aliases too. And what I will tell you is that the return that comes back may have a name different than the name you submitted, and be cautioned that that person might not be the criminal. You need to talk to the person. State law requires you to not discriminate against them in certain circumstances.
But you read the trial transcripts here. They had experts testifying how these are reviewed, and after you get so many of them, you skip them over. You have experts testifying on what's the mindset of people, and that they go to these or have these reports, and they are coming there not to read, but the experts say with a mission in mind, finding out is there a rap sheet and there is or isn't there, and they skip right over this stuff. So what's your responsibility? What's the responsibility of the Department of Justice with regard to these crime victims under Article 1, Section 9M and 950.01, the Crime Victims Bill of Rights?
In response to that, I would say there's also an interest in not having them re-victimized.
That's right, and I think that's what you're doing. So tell me how this is implicated.
Because Dennis A. Teague's name has been used and may again in the future be used by Anthony Terrell Parker, and we do not know if he is going to use that name again. And victims of identity theft, I think you'll find in the literature, are many times re-victimized because the people who buy and sell identities go off, and DOJ does not know who the person is. That was the question, who the person is that's being
submitted. See, I think you're re-victimizing them. That's the re-victimization I was talking about. Now you have people who are crime victims who might not be able to volunteer for positions and not even know that they're being checked out. You have people, and you have the testimony at trial of the Colwyn witness, Colwyn plaintiff, who said she has this innocence letter, but she's a nurse, I think, and if I recall correctly. And it's not good enough, so she has to resubmit and reprove it to the employers. And she is afraid, she says, she's going to be moving out of state. And how does this work when out of state if they get the rap sheet? Then what is she supposed to do? These are crime victims. You're re-victimizing them.
And we're saying there are competing interests in here because people may be re-victimized by the same criminal who submitted their name in the first place. And we don't know, and that's that DOJ has the discretion to balance and say that we are, under Chapter 165, doing what the legislature told us to do. Chapter 165 says that we're supposed to...
Counsel, is that balancing not subject to judicial review?
I don't think it's subject to judicial review under any of the claims asserted in this lawsuit.
All right. But let me put a little finer point on the question that Justice Bradley was asking. You said that the information that you provide in response to these requests is accurate, but that depends on the question being asked, doesn't it?
Yes.
Okay. And the question being asked when someone accesses your reporting system is, does this person whose name I'm going to enter have a criminal history? Right? That's the question being asked.
I disagree.
Why? Well, it's not an idle scholastic inquiry into whether that name appears in the criminal record database, is it?
What the testimony at trial was that what the users are submitting is a name and a date of birth and perhaps other information.
Right.
And the DOJ is telling them.
They want to know, does this person have a criminal history?
But I think you need to also credit what the response of DOJ is,
I don't think I do, for the sake of my question at least.
And I think.
So, hang on. So the question is, coming from the user of the system, does this person have a criminal history? The report comes back, and the report says, probably, right? I mean, if to give full credit to the caveats included in the report, puts the person's name on top of the sheet, has a bunch of form language, and then it has a criminal history. The answer that you gave is, yeah, it's got a criminal history. You sort through the details, but this is what we're associating with that name, right?
No, I disagree. What I'm saying is that people are asking for us to run a name-based query, and we
They're asking what?
The users are asking the Department of Justice to run a name-based query.
Okay, so that's step one.
If they misunderstand what they're purchasing, because they're refusing to read our instructions and they're refusing to read the return, I don't think that should be credited against DOJ under one of the five causes of action that they've asserted here.
Okay, but the reason they're asking for a name-based inquiry is what?
They want to know if that name appears in our database.
No, they don't. They want to know if that person has a criminal history. Right? I mean, it's not an academic exercise for them. They're trying to find out this person that they're going to hire as a Sunday school teacher, Mr. Lettington, want to know, did you have a criminal history? Right? Isn't that what they're asking?
Right, and the response comes back, here is where the name appears. The name appears that this name has appeared as an alias for a criminal. Now, you should probably go talk to that person and make sure that that's the real person, or look at their challenge letter that the DOJ has provided, or read the instructions that DOJ has provided. But we are erring on the side of providing you more information, and I agree that we are providing more information because what we don't want to happen is we don't want the fraudster to repeatedly use the system and say, my name is Dennis A. Teague, hire me for this position that is substantially related to a crime I've been convicted of. That's what we have balanced, and we've decided that it's better to err on the side of providing what the legislature told us to provide, which is a name-based search under Chapter 165.
All right. Now, is there any method by which any person in the state of Wisconsin would be able to bring a claim to challenge that balance that the DOJ does? Or is that beyond review?
So the question is, are there hypothetical claims that people could bring against the government?
I want to know, from DOJ's perspective, is this balancing that it does entirely beyond review by the court?
Well, under Chapter 227.52, any final decision of an agency can be challenged. And if they are submitting a request under, for example, 1970, and we make a decision under 1970 that we are not going to correct your record. Let's say, for example, you were arrested for fraud, and we put you're arrested for bail jumping. And they came to us, and they said, please correct the record. And we said, no. That's a final decision subject to 227.
Okay. So is this report that you produce in response to the name-based inquiry, is that report a record? Is that report that is produced in response to name-based inquiry, is that report a record?
Yes.
All right. So that record is subject to 19.70.
Yes.
Are you done?
Yeah.
I have a question.
Yes.
You state in your material, and I heard you state, that if I were going to request a record, and I'm picking Daniel Kelly, because I would think there's more than one Daniel Kelly. I looked around the bench and I thought that was most likely. So if I were going to ask you for a record of Daniel Kelly, if I just said Daniel Kelly, is that enough for you to respond to my request?
No, Your Honor.
That's what I thought you'd say. And you would say you have to give something else, and date of birth is probably it. Okay. So I would then give Daniel Kelly and his date of birth. Now, is the record that you produced relating to A, whatever his name is, Anthony, ATP. ATP, okay. You produced a record on ATP. And you have a date of birth, right?
Yes.
Is his date of birth Mr. Teague's date of birth?
No, Your Honor.
Then you produced a record that asked for Teague, date of birth blank, and you produced a record for ATP, a different date of birth. How can that, you didn't produce the record requested?
Yes, our agents at CIB are trained to produce possible matches.
How's a possible match if you insist that I give you a date of birth, but you produce a record that isn't a date of birth, that does so these people don't match? I had, unfortunately, have medical issues, and you can't give your name only at the hospital. You've got to give the date of birth. In fact, you give the name, it's irrelevant, the date of birth, of which hundreds of people are born on the same day. So unless you do both, you don't have an identification. So I'm confused as to how you give this record when it doesn't match what you're asked for. And if you're so concerned about this, why don't you, which you should be, I agree, and for our victims, why don't you send the record to Mr. Teague?
Send which record to Mr. Teague?
The record on ATP. Well, I mean, you don't want another identity theft. You want to protect him. That's why you're giving out the alias. I mean, that's what I heard you say. But you don't ever tell him that there's a record on him.
Right. Just to back up and step back 1 minute, the request that comes in that's name-based is run through a computer system similar to CCAP, where people insert names into CCAP and they get responses, and the response may say this person has a criminal felony conviction. So the response goes into the computer, and if the names and the birth dates and the race and the sex match up above a certain score, there's an automatic return. If they don't match anybody below a certain score, it returns there's no record, there's no criminal history. In between, those queries go to one of 19 CIB employees who have to make judgments about whether the name submitted sufficiently matches to someone in the database that we should alert the user and the customer who paid $7 that there is a possible match here and that they should take further steps to ensure that these are the same or different people. And so, getting back to the causes of action here, under 19.356, I think it's very important that this court identify that this is a classic type of judicial review. In Moustakas and Milwaukee Teachers and Wozniacki, all those cases confirm that a pre-release challenge under the balancing test is, quote, judicial review.
But what's pre-release here?
They're seeking a forward-looking injunction and a forward-looking declaration.
I'd like to refine Justice Abrahamson's question, and I was interested in her line of questioning and the others. This is what Mr. Meyer was alluding to, I think, earlier. The Moustakas, District Attorney Moustakas, had the opportunity, that pre-release in that case had to do with a personnel record where he got the notification. He wanted the notification and he wanted the opportunity to object. And so I'm not sure how that is on all fours with this situation where we're talking about an automated response system, which is called in the documents, the criminal background check was performed by searching the following data. Now, you're gonna have a good response to that, I'm sure. But I'm going to ask you to make several assumptions, some of which you're not going to like. But I'm going to ask you. I'm going to ask you to assume that there are members of the bench who are concerned about about people whose names are out there and who get pulled into the system and spit out through no fault of their own. In the scenario related, it doesn't take much of a stretch of imagination or empathy, I think, to think about the scenario that Justice Ann Walsh Bradley related before. I'd also like you to assume perhaps that no one is thinking the government is maliciously or intentionally doing this to citizens. And I'd like you to assume that maybe some members of the bench are looking for a way to help correct this situation. And if all those assumptions are true, what would your recommendation be?
I think that if I was going to make a recommendation, that I would focus on 1970.
Okay, how so?
That statute has never been interpreted or ruled upon by this court. It would be very important to do that. And I think that statute in the legislature says that if there is a government record that's inaccurate, that there is a process that the agency ought to go through. At step zero, though, we think his claim fails because we don't feel he's challenging the accuracy of a record. So let's just set that aside. Okay. Let's assume you're actually challenging the accuracy of a record. For example, I was convicted of bail jumping. I was not convicted of a criminal felony.
Yes,
and misdemeanor, something like
I
that.
Understand.
So the statute's text allows the agency to either concur or correct. I think that's a good first step. If the agency denies the challenge, they have a duty to notify the individual under the statute and allow the individual to file a concise statement, setting forth the reasons for their dispute with the disputed portion of the record.
What happens with that filing? I don't want to interrupt your answer, but I'm just curious. What do they do? I mean, what's that mean?
And then who reviews the decision after, as part of your answer to Justice Ziegler's question?
Right.
Who reviews?
So this statute, I can speak from DOJ's experience, has been used very rarely and most commonly in the circumstance of a personnel dispute where someone was at the Department of Justice. They have been terminated for a reason X, and the person submits a letter saying, I was not terminated for reason X, that was not true, and that we would take that letter and we put it in the file, so whenever someone asks for the personnel file, that would be produced as a supplementation similar to the supplementation under 19.3569, and that's where it would go. Now, any of these decisions that the agency makes is a final decision under 227.52 and could be reviewed in a judicial petition for judicial review in the circuit court, and there could be a record, and maybe my refusal to correct the record is arbitrary and capricious. Then a circuit court could say, yes, that's arbitrary and capricious. What you ought to do is correct the record. That is what you should have done under 1970. I think that if I was concerned about inaccurate government records, that's the path I would go down. I would not say that people have a right to challenge the balancing test for a denial, or balancing test for a release of a record. Because what one thing I want to point out is that when the legislature put these remedies in the public records law, they provided very broad remedies under 1937 to compel release, right? Because the public records law wants to compel release, but they provided very narrow remedies.
I don't understand what you mean by that. How would someone challenge the balancing test? What do you mean by that?
Well, their challenge, their first claim is under the balancing test. They say we misbalanced this and therefore we should not release the record.
Right.
And so what I'm saying is that when the legislature provided remedies for the public records law, it provided broad remedies to compel a release and very narrow remedies to prevent a release, because we don't under, you know, was the dissents in Milwaukee Teachers and Wozniacki were very prescient of what the legislature eventually did, which was to say, we are limiting public records challenges because we don't want every record subject to run to court and say, don't release that record because our public records law would be tied up in litigation.
So if I understand what you're saying, is you're saying that if the court is concerned about a problem here, they shouldn't get all involved in public records law. Well, we have a lot of case law and a lot of challenges to it over the years that we've addressed. They should just focus on 1970 and work through the process that that provides.
And the accuracy now, of each individual record.
You know, we got a couple of letters either this week or at the end of last week from you and from opposing counsel.
Yesterday and this morning.
Was it just yesterday and this morning? Okay, well, I read them both, and I didn't know what to make of them. Frankly, I'll tell you what I thought of your letter, because I got it first and read it, and then I read the one that just came in, dated yesterday. I guess they're both dated yesterday. In any case, I thought you were admitting you had a problem. Otherwise, why would you send me this everybody on the bench, this letter? Went to Diane Fremgen, who then, of course, sends it to us, who's Diane's our clerk of court. So should we take this letter as a concession that there is a problem with the report as DOJ is currently generating those reports?
What the purpose of the letter was to update the court as to what we mentioned in our brief was that DOJ is continually trying to improve this process.
Okay, but that wasn't my question to you.
Yes.
My question, you can just say yes or no, and I'll probably make my own conclusion anyway. But my question to you was the letter a concession that there is a problem with the reports that are generated under this system?
Not a legal concession as to that one of his five claims produces a remedy that would bind us. It's a mere fact that we are improving our system. And at the end of the day, when Dennis A. Teague is queried and his UPIN is provided, it will say no criminal history. That is the best result we think that we can muster under the statutory scheme.
Okay.
Yeah. Can I follow that up? I read your response caveat quite carefully. You think this would tell me after I read everything, including your three-page, two-and-a-half-page introduction, blah, 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 that Dean Teague does not have a criminal history, that Dennis Teague does not have a criminal history?
No.
That's what I thought.
It would warn the reader that Dennis A. Teague's name has been the subject of a successful identity challenge, and they should use caution in assuming that ATP, who has his photograph here, is the same person as Dennis A. Teague.
Well, you know what? So what do you need the caveat for? That was true before you put in a caveat. Everything you just said was there before. So what do you need a caveat for?
The caveat identifies that there are 400 people in the state of Wisconsin that hold these identity challenge letters that we have issued. The red caveat at the very top tells the reader that Dennis A. Teague is one of those 400 people.
Where does it say 400?
It doesn't say 400, but there are 400.
Well, it doesn't say that. I'm just reading this. This is all I know. The Wisconsin Department of Justice has received a successful fingerprint-based challenge to this record from an individual whose name is similar or whose identity was stolen and used during arrest. Well, in this record, there are several people. Anton U. T. Parker, Anthony T. Parker, Mario Terrell Parker, Dennis Antonio Teague. I don't know from your red response caveat whose fingerprints were given that say it's not I, because it could be any one of these four or five aliases.
Right, it's a caution signal to the user.
Well, you cautioned me as a reader of this, one, two, three pages of single-spaced print. Now you're cautioning me in red, and it doesn't say anything that helps me determine whether you got the right guy or I got the right guy.
Just identifies more information, which is one of our goals, is to provide more information.
Isn't it possible to change your algorithm so you have to have a match of more than you have a match now before you issue a report that's tagged on to someone? I mean,
Yes. These
are all run by algorithms, so if you had to have the same date of birth and the same name, you certainly would do better, and if you had other criteria. I don't know, are you using the SID, state identification number,
yes,
at DOJ?
Yes.
Okay, so you can put that into the mix perhaps as well, but I'm not into directing DOJ, but it seems to me you could do more than issue a letter that now has got a red writing on the top, which, as Justice Abraham says, doesn't really help her answer the question. She was already cautioned by what you sent out. So is she more cautioned if it's in red? I don't know, but you know, I do wonder, can't you make an algorithm that does what you're supposed to do under the legislation, but has more points before you issue a report that this person is in the system?
Yeah, as a matter of policy, that's absolutely true. And we have improved the system even over the summer by allowing us to return more than one result. Before July of 2016, we were only returning one result. Mm-hmm. Now our employees can return multiple results, perhaps similar to CCAP, when you type someone's name in and it lists a bunch of people that have a similar name, and the user can decide, does this person have a felony conviction or not, or are they just an innocent person? I think you would also find that employers also search CCAP.
Well, we're not here on CCAP. We have our own committee, by the way, which is meeting monthly since we've gone to e-filing with CCAP to be sure that what is available is given appropriate care, and it's complicated since we've gone to e-filing. So you don't need to argue with me about CCAP. I know that we are looking at that. You have a problem with DOJ. Yeah, that's what we're here on today.
Here's the broader question when I read this. Is justice, fairness, protection of the victim to be governed by an algorithm, or is it governed by something else? Because what you're here saying is, oh, they got this database and it pours it out, and the end, even though we're dealing with a victim of identity theft. And I don't see how the state and how a constitutional right of privacy is governed by an algorithm.
May I answer, Chief Justice?
Yes, please.
My response to that would be that we could add social security numbers. We could add fingerprints. We could do all sorts of things, but our users would not like it, and they would use it less.
Well, you know what? I didn't see somewhere that this is for the user, and you're not even doing it on date of birth. That's what bothers me. If you had Teague, and you had this guy ATP and the right date of birth for Teague, I'd say, okay, you had two identifiers, you got the right thing. You're only using his name. You asked for two, you're only using his name, and this is what comes up. You're not even adhering to what I think are your own rules.
Just to clarify that last point on date of birth, the reason the CIB employee returned it is because it's only 6 days later, and that the CIB employer thought that a six-day discrepancy with a birth date and an identical name
you know,
was close enough.
For his parents, 6 days make a lot of difference, especially for his mother. There's either a birth date on a particular date, and I can see confusion if the child is born at 11:59 or 12:01. But I don't see confusion for 6 days. And if that's part of your database and your analysis, I find that very interesting.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Rebuttal, please.
I have 3 points I want to get to. One of them is, I think Mr. Kelly has conceded the procedural due process argument in his observations about Chapter 227. If it is true that he concedes that Chapter 227 is a remedy, that is the process that should be ordered under the Matthews versus Eldridge balancing test.
Well, what's the final order that we're reviewing then?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What's the final order that's review in this case that's reviewable under 227?
Reverse the denial of plaintiff's motion for summary judgment on the procedural due process claim, and reverse with instructions to conduct the Matthews versus Eldridge balancing test. That's the relief from this court. And that allows...
Why would we want to do that when we can just interpret 1970? I can tell you, I rarely, if ever, vote to do a constitutional issue if it can be resolved by a statutory answer. So why should I go there?
And here's the answer, Your Honor, because I don't think Mr. Kelly is going to be representing the department when we get back below. And I believe, based on 40 years of practicing law, that when we bring a Chapter 227 petition for judicial review about our dissatisfaction with the challenge response, they are going to tell us Chapter 227 does not apply. That's exactly what their response is going to be, is that we are not entitled to use 227.
Well, we've got 1970. We can sit here and interpret a statute. We do it
on a
very regular basis.
But, Your Honor, imagine that they get 1970 wrong. Imagine that they make a mistake.
I thought you were arguing to us that they did get it wrong, that the report was inaccurate. That's how I read your brief.
I'm sorry. No, imagine that when we make a challenge under 1970, the department makes, under that 1970 challenge, a legal or factual mistake. They could. What is our remedy? Our remedy, I hope you would also say, is a Chapter 227 review of that 19.70 decision. That, I think, would satisfy the procedural due process.
Well, he said go to circuit court.
That would go to circuit court, yes.
That's what he said.
Yes, but, Your Honor, I can...
I didn't take his as a concession on due process.
Because I asked him to assume a few things,
yes.
and if the assumptions were true. So it was not...
I understand, but it does seem to me that the point is this court needs to tell the Department of Justice and needs to tell the citizens of Wisconsin that there is a judicial forum to correct problems, disagreements under the 19.70 challenge process.
My concern is this. I have in the appendix what it looks like for a no criminal history found. It's one half page.
Yep.
So now, with regard to 19.70, you read the briefs and they say we've totally complied with 19.70. You're not challenging the accuracy. What kind of hoops are victims of crime going to be put through? Oh, now let's do a 227. And they have hired an attorney, and then you go to circuit court because they're private reputational interests are being violated and they're again being re-victimized. I mean, get it right. This is what you're looking for.
Yes.
You're not looking for having these victims spend thousands of dollars, and unless they have legal aid representation, thousands of dollars and years of their life to have the DOJ say, oh, we're doing everything fine under 19.70. I'm not so sure 19.70, since there's such a denial of a problem, that they're going to be able to rectify the problem under 19.70.
Your Honor, my vision to protect victims of crime would be a simple process under 19.70 in which the victim says, I am innocent. And the result is, under 1970, the department says, you're right, you get a clean record. From here on in, your match will be a clean record. If the department wants to say in a supplementary report, oh, by the way, Dennis Teague, you are innocent, and requester of Dennis Teague's information, there's this other guy named Parker who 20 years ago once used Dennis Teague's name, but Dennis is innocent. That's my goal, a simple, effective challenge under 1970. subject to the review of the courts, where we have a system where I don't have to spend the next 6 years of my career litigating to protect the victim.
Thank you very much, Counsel. Thank you both for very, very good arguments and excellent briefs. This is really quite a conundrum, and I can see it's not an easy problem on either side. So thank you. We enjoyed the argument, and the briefs were wonderful. We're going to take a brief...